You're listening to The Rhetoric of Cancer on the World Service with me, Andrew Greystone.
So where does the story begin, Andrew?
I guess it begins about 4 years ago in a windowless office in the hospital in Manchester, where a doctor looked up from an orange cardboard folder and said, "You have cancer."
Gosh.
And in a sense, the second half of my autobiography starts from that moment.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the journey with cancer from that point on was as much a journey of the mind, a spiritual journey, as it was a physical process of dealing with the cancer. And I found that as I told my friends and family about it, I was struggling to find a good language to describe what was going on.
What did you find problematic with the language?
Well, I found that a lot of the language of cancer was very masculine, military sort of language. People said to me, "You're strong, you're brave, you'll be able to fight this."
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'm not sure if I am strong or brave, and I'm not really the fighting type. Are there other ways that we can describe this experience? So I've wanted in this programme to meet with a number of people who encounter cancer in different ways and to explore with them the rhetoric, the language that they use to talk about cancer. First, I went back to the Christie Hospital in Manchester in the UK, where I was treated for my cancer. And I met in the hospital waiting room with Dr. Wendy Makin, who's the Macmillan consultant in palliative care and oncology. I wanted to find out what language clinicians use to describe cancer and whether Dr. Makin felt there's any value in using this battling metaphor to describe people's experience of cancer.
I think that for all of us, if you open a paper or see something on the news, whether it's a celebrity or someone in the local community who sadly has died of their cancer, the language is all around losing the fight, losing the battle. Now, I think partly that might be around media sensationalism, but I think there's something else there as well. I think there is a recognition that for many people, dealing with cancer, living with it and dying from cancer can be a struggle. And I think that sometimes that language is used by their family, by the people they work with, their friends, really out of respect and recognition of what that person has gone through, that they dealt with it in the best way they could, very bravely. And we often see this in people living with their cancer. But the bottom line is that people need some way of making sense of all of this and to find their way of how they're going to deal with it, how they're going to get through it, or live alongside it.
Live alongside it is very interesting language for me. Live with the experience, live with cancer.
I sometimes use that to help people put cancer in perspective, particularly if it's someone who also has had ischemic heart disease, angina, had coronary bypass operations, or they've got chronic chest problems. In reality, they've been living alongside other life-threatening conditions, but they haven't seen it in the same way as they now see their cancer, and their cancer makes them far more frightened. And sometimes that fear is disproportionate.
Yes, and the fear has come from the bogeyman that we've created, that we've made cancer as a culture. It's made it harder. There was more than 3 years between my being diagnosed with cancer and my being treated, so I had quite a long time of living with cancer and carrying it around with me and taking it to every social occasion and taking it to bed with me and waking up with it. So I learned to live with these cells, these rogue cells.
So what are the things, when you look back, that helped you in getting your head round the knowledge of the cancer.
It helped me to be able to own those cancerous cells as a part of my body and something that I had created, not something that had come in from outside or an invading force, but a part of me, like any other part of me. I don't like all the parts of my body equally. Some of them I like fairly much, and some of them I dislike a bit more. But I have to learn to love the bits of my body that I don't like so much. And I had to try to love these cancer cells, because I didn't want to declare a civil war in my own body. I didn't want to be a battleground. It doesn't help anyone to hate their own body. Wendy introduces this idea of living alongside cancer, which I find quite helpful. But Wendy was also conscious that we're dealing with a bogeyman, a monster that we've created. Now, some of that comes through the kind of advertising and public discussion that we see of cancer. So I wanted to meet somebody who's involved in the business of promoting cancer research and fundraising for that. So I went to a very modern, busy office in the centre of London to meet Natasha Hill, who's the Director of Brand and Strategic Marketing at Cancer Research UK. And I asked her how they describe cancer in ways that encourage people to give money to cancer research.
More recently, we've started to personify cancer a little bit more, which is something that we never used to do.
What do you mean by that? How does that work out?
We've started to get into territories where we think of cancer as an enemy, which is language that many patients, survivors, carers of cancer patients refer to.
An enemy?
An enemy.
Yes, I've seen some posters, I think, come from you saying things like, cancer, the gloves are off.
Yes.
Cancer, you and me outside now, which is fighting talk.
Yes, so that was Race for Life advertising.
And that's turning cancer into a person.
A thing that you want to fight.
So speak to directly.
Exactly. Yeah. And the main line for that campaign was, cancer, we're coming to get you.
Yeah. It's quite threatening. It's kind of fighting
talk,
isn't it? Yes,
that one, that campaign in particular, we did a lot of work with consumers before going into that. It was a very new area for us.
So lots of people like that kind of talk or respond well to it.
Yes, yeah. If we're talking to people who are, say, over 60, we use very different language to the Race for Life campaign, where it's probably the most provocative that we've been before.
I had two things to worry about when I got cancer. The big fight against cancer as a whole that I want to see, you know, eradicated by research. But I also have my own little collection of cancer cells, and I didn't want to fight them because they were mine, they were part of me, and I didn't want to declare a kind of civil war in my own body. I needed to find a better way of living with the cancer that I'd got.
But presumably you'd rather those cancer cells went away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, what language would you prefer to refer to those cancer cells going away?
Well, I'm still struggling to find a good language for it. I lived with cancer for over 3 years, knowing that I had cancer before I had any treatment to remove it. And it was a bit like giving hospitality to an unwelcome guest. But I didn't want to fight it because I don't want to fight myself.
But if it was, and maybe that's your particular type of cancer, but if it was a cancer that was going to progress and could cause a premature death, you'd want to fight that, wouldn't you?
Except there's hardly anything I can do to fight it. I couldn't operate on myself. I couldn't... what could I do to fight my own cancer? I was very passive in it.
And I suppose that is...
And yet I was being told, you've got to fight this thing.
by others.
I found that difficult, yeah. Mm. Well, I thought I was. I thought that's what people were saying.
That's unusual for most cancers. So prostate cancer is a particular cancer where it can be controlled and people can live with it.
But even if you've got a cancer that needs treatment very urgently or that's very severe, most of us as patients can't do much fighting ourselves.
No, but what we know about some patients is this, sometimes the fight for them means an emotional commitment to doing everything that they can to make sure they're eating healthily through their treatment, to getting the rest so that they are supporting, if you like, the treatments that are given to them through the, you know, the experts,
yeah.
Be that, you know, surgery or chemotherapy, radiotherapy, drugs, etc., that they want to take part in doing their bit.
I've come to the Henry Wellcome Building at the University of Birmingham, and I'm here with Professor Michael Overdin, who is the Professor of Structural Biology within the School of Cancer Sciences here. We're outside a bare white room with the most enormous structure in the middle of it. Could you explain what that is?
Sure. The magnet looks a bit like a lunar lander, but it's actually designed to peer into the smallest parts of life, the proteins that are involved in controlling how cells grow and divide, how they move. And what our job is as scientists is to figure out how those molecules work, what really makes them tick, what they look like in space, and how to stop them from misbehaving in, for example, a cancer cell.
Do your colleagues here who are researching into cancer think of themselves as engaging in a battle?
The battle analogy is a peculiar one. In the end, we're scientists, we want to be objective, and so it's not something I'm typically using on my day-to-day job. But then again, I work with companies that design warheads for cancer. So warheads are small parts of drug molecules. Exactly. It's a very specific term that refers to the part of a drug molecule that hits the target. And
A target,
exactly. And so we use these analogies in part because science can be a bit dry. Here we generate lots of numbers, and we want to be able to have metaphors to make it much more real and personal.
So you need metaphors too, like I've needed metaphors for dealing with cancer.
I think we always deal with metaphors. It makes it much more understandable. There's more drama to it. In the end, it's pretty hard knows what we're doing. We're trying to design a few atoms that work together to hit a part of a protein and stop it from behaving in the way that causes cancer. And so we, at the same time, need to avoid all the other proteins that aren't involved in the cancer. And so it's about developing a very specific targeted approach where we just hit the one protein and don't hit the other 20,000 proteins that might be doing their job normally in the
collateral
human body.
Damage.
Exactly. And I think we use these metaphors to simplify it. And also it helps with funding agencies that are fighting for funding to describe what they're up against as a battle. I think it's more difficult for the patient because it's difficult to be at war with part of yourself. It seems counterintuitive, almost wrong, to think of a war against something that's in your body, that's from your own body.
That's what I felt as well.
Sure. So I think at a personal level, it doesn't make sense. But at the level of the murkiness of science and trying to find simple solutions that hopefully do have the profound outcomes that we want, i.e. stopping cancer, it helps us, I guess, simplify that.
Do you know where the metaphor of the war on cancer came from?
The metaphor came from the U.S. when Nixon announced the war on cancer. They wanted to beat cancer and do it quickly. And the reality is we found since then that it isn't easy, it isn't quick, and it's an ongoing journey. And I think we really need to not talk about being at war with ourselves, but really have compassion and understanding of what the individual patient needs to go through.
Is there any other language, other than the language of warfare, that's been helpful to you in thinking about cancer?
In the end, I focus on the names of the individual proteins, the genes, the molecules, and that's really the playground of the scientists, free of the kind of the more negative metaphors. That's what I work with on a day-to-day basis. And so there's this whole playground of molecules working together with a purpose to keep a cell, a tissue, an organ functioning. And we're just now trying to understand what the puzzle pieces are within a cell. I think the next step is really to see how those puzzle pieces all fit together. And then finally, in a cancer cell, for example, how they don't fit together.
I like the fact that you're exploring, you're puzzling this out, that you're not necessarily coming into work with a furrowed brow because you've got something to fight, but you're being inquisitive on my behalf about the way this thing works or doesn't work. Is battling the best metaphor for what's actually going on at cellular level, or are there other ways of describing it?
We think of cells as having many switches, like a lot of light switches, and they need to be turned on or off depending on whether it's time to grow or time to stop growing. And so each protein in a cell, and there are many, acts like a switch. They communicate with one another. And so we think of cells as a system of relays and connections, not really a battle where you win and lose, more as a symphony, like a series of sounds and messages and communications that have to work together to create something beautiful, life. And when you start to get notes that play wrong, that are dissonant, and cancer cells don't grow properly, then you get problems.
If you've got an orchestra and one of the instruments is playing out of tune, you don't go in and vomit, you go in and retune it.
That's a good analogy, I like that. And that's what we're trying to do with a small molecule. You go and fix the instrument or maybe retrain the musician. And so here we're trying to design very small molecules that do a big job, that get that cancer cell back on track.
The thing that struck me most in meeting Michael was his tremendous sense of awe at seeing how the human body works at that tiny microscopic level. He seemed to think that cells were wonderful things, but it was in the context of spending his life amazed at the way the human body works.
Yes, that's very clear, isn't it? There's that reverence, really, for the mystery of it. And then trying to find a way to tactfully intervene in that process.
To work along with it instead of against it.
Exactly, yeah. So where did you need to go next? What was the next part of the journey?
Well, I went all the way to the furthest northwestern tip of Wales to meet Jim Cotter, who is a poet and priest who's had cancer in a much more severe way than I did, and it's brought him close to the end of his life. So I wanted to hear his perspective.
I was diagnosed with a form of leukemia in August 2011. So I've been living with this for a couple of years, had 18 months, quote-quote, remission. Not a phrase I'm comfortable with. It sounds as though you've been let out of prison early for good behaviour. I prefer to think of it as an unfolding drama in an unknown, as yet unknown, number of acts. The intermission is an interval, and you don't quite know whether it'll be two or three. I think the most vivid metaphor that was used was not by the head of department, as it were, but one of his colleagues. And he said, well, your bone marrow has become rather like a garden that's been taken over by the weeds. And we send in a weed killer, which unfortunately devastates the whole garden, and you become like a... Well, no, he didn't use this. I thought of pictures of battlefields of the First World War. You know, where everything is devastated that's living. But then he said that the good plants will come back again. But it was weed killer. In other words, you are matching force with force. And I think at a microbiological level, which I don't understand as a scientist at all, that is what is going on. The cancerous cells, they're like clones. They multiply, they spread devastation through the countryside because they're looking for food to eat the whole time. And I certainly think at that level, the picture of a sort of goose-stepping army is vivid, fairly accurate, and quite alarming. And as with war itself, you know, this is not something we would choose, but, you know, you have to ask, is this war just, and whose side are you on at certain points?
So you did feel that you were conscripted into a battle at that stage?
Well, probably like yourself, I'm not entirely at ease with that series of war pictures. And I also thought to myself, well, this is something which is part of my own bloodstream. It's mine. And how do we get on? And is there another way of getting on rather than one lot trying to obliterate the other lot? The image comes of then of of can I give safe harbour or even hospitality to this unwelcome entity. I did have conversations with this somewhat clumsy giant called Luke Kimia, who then turned into a heavyweight boxer, and I was having a number of bouts in the ring. That was a way of beginning to cope with my relationship with the cancer. I find myself thinking of and talking about light and dark, and light angels and dark angels.
Yes.
And Wilco, the poet, talks a lot about dark angels.
And cancer is a dark angel.
Well, you see, yes, and is it necessarily for ill? Now that gets onto a different level of this, because we've come to expect a longer lifespan than our parents, nor certainly our grandparents. This is where the angel that seems to be dark actually is the messenger of your dying. Well, I've got to have some messenger, you know, I'm not going to live forever.
I was reading the obituary of a colleague the other day, and it said, as they so often do, he lost his battle with cancer.
Yeah.
And I thought, if somebody writes in my obituary, he lost his battle with cancer, I should come back and haunt them.
Yes.
All the people I've met and talked to in making this programme have been inspiring in their own way.
Mm.
They all seemed as if cancer had given them a sense of life,
exactly,
and immediacy,
exactly,
and urgency.
Mm.
And in a very strange way, it's been a gift.
Yes, or rather they've used it as a gift.
Or they've used it as a gift.
It is what it is, but they've turned it into a gift. Yeah.
Part of the picture for me is that I come to this as a believing Christian, and I wanted some help to pull this journey together, so I went to see an old friend, Paula Gooder, who is a Christian theologian who has a lot of insight into the way that a Christian faith understands good and evil.
Certainly in the New Testament, particularly in books like the Book of Revelation right at the end, you've got this image of battle used solely, really, for fighting against the powers of evil, fighting against the devil and his angels. That's the language where battling comes up time and time again in the New Testament. And it is interesting to note, isn't it, that when we fall back on a metaphor for describing our relationship with illness, we fall back on the metaphor that's most often used of evil. I wonder whether there is an at least implicit connection there between illness and evil.
I'm wondering if it's possible for me to say illness is a bad thing, cancer is a bad thing, and I'd rather it didn't exist, and I'd rather it wasn't in the world. But it's not necessarily an evil, it might be just part of the way the world is. Leaves fall from the trees in autumn, the sun goes down in the evening. There's a sadness about those things, but not necessarily a wrongness. They're just part of the way that life is.
Certainly, if you can move it from saying to saying that there is a sadness and a loss and a bereavement about the dying that happens in the world, but that we don't necessarily want to say that that is always tied up with evil.
I'm wondering what that means for the way that I should treat my cancer.
Is it about allowing yourself to grieve? Because if you move the language, the metaphor, from something that is absolutely evil that must be battled at all costs into the language more of recognising that it is a dying that is a part of life, well, what we do with death is we grieve for it. And is there something in an attitude to illness that actually you grieve for what is lost, which is slightly more healthy than battling?
Some people have talked about living with cancer or walking or journeying with cancer or even giving hospitality.
Yes. Well, the concept of befriending is one that is kind of there at the outskirts of my mind, which is a very difficult one, isn't it? Because it implies that you're saying that this is a good, and again, I wouldn't want to go there.
Some people are going to find that very, very hard.
Yes.
You know, particularly a parent with a child
Absolutely.
Who has cancer.
Indeed.
If we were to say to them, oh, you need to befriend that cancer.
I'm just trying to explore the concept of whether befriending something
actually means bringing it into your experience of living. And as you befriend it, there are bits about it you will welcome and bits about it you will resist very strongly. But it will become a part of who you are.
Do you know what I want to do? I want to kiss my cancer goodbye.
Mm. Yes. That's never
occurred to me before, this moment.
And that is a bereavement image, isn't it?
I hate to say this because I know it's so hard for people with cancer to take, but there is a sense of grieving my cancer going. I'm so glad that it's gone. Don't misunderstand me. But there's a grief as well because it's been a part of my journey. It's been like a hitchhiker that I picked up along the way that I never meant to, but I gave a ride to for a time, and I'm a better person for it. You've been listening to The Rhetoric of Cancer with me, Andrew Greystone. My conversation partner has been Deirdre Burton, and the producer was Rosie Bolton. You can hear a longer version of this programme with fuller interviews online. This has been a Monty Funk production for the BBC World Service.